I'm going to be reading the second chapter of Daniel this morning, and as I was getting ready over the last couple of days, I've been struck by two individuals in Scripture. So we've been taking a break from Exodus during the summer to get into the book of Daniel a little bit, and I was thinking about Moses, particularly this morning. And if I were to meet Moses, I think I would find that I relate to Moses really, really well. He's usually getting ahead of himself. He's usually not waiting on God. God usually has to break through in some dramatic fashion with Moses, like a bush that's burning but not being consumed. And God reveals his entire plan to Moses and exactly what he needs to do and how God will act. And Moses still finds excuse for not doing what God wants him to do. So I think I find that I relate to Moses. Daniel, if I were to meet Daniel, I would look up to Daniel. So Daniel pursues God and then expects and knows that God will act. And Daniel gives all credit to God. And when God acts in this story of second chapter in Daniel, others around know that it's not Daniel, but it's God. So this is the second chapter of Daniel. And it's a long one, but it's a good story. So sit back and relax. And here we go. In the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and the king said to them, "I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation." The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made an ash heap. However, if you tell the dream that it's, and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." They answered again and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation." The king answered and said, "I know for certain that you would gain time, because you see that my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then, with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of the God of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand." Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation." Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, "I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation." The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?" Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living. But for our sakes who make known the interpretation of the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall rise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all wise men of Babylon. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king.
All right, you guys follow all of that? This morning we're going to talk about enculturation, which is more or less a fancy word for peer pressure. It's the process by which living in a culture, enculturation, causes you to become more like that culture. Okay. And that can happen really violently and suddenly. If Stephen, the missionary we're going to be partnering with, goes back to a place like Egypt and gets arrested, then a gun will be put to his head, and they'll say, "Become Muslim again, be enculturated right now, this minute, or die." Right? That's possible, but that's not the normal way that enculturation happens. Enculturation is usually much slower and more subtle. When I was a kid, my parents would take us to the Life and Science Museum in Durham, North Carolina, which has got all kinds of cool exhibits for kids, and one of them that sort of teaches you about momentum and gravity wasn't anything more than this giant convex funnel. So it was about this big around, and then it sloped down like this into the bottom. And all you did, you put a penny in at the top, and it went down a ramp and starts going around the very top of the funnel. And at first it's moving very slowly, and you think it's not actually going anywhere, that it's just orbiting. But the orbit is decaying slowly. So the penny's dropping down bit by bit and going faster and faster and faster until at the bottom it's moving so fast you can't even see it, and then eventually drops through the bottom of the funnel and down to where every other poor sap has dropped all their pennies. And then I guess, you know, they take that and they feed the bears or something. That's how enculturation usually happens. We live in a culture that has a sort of gravitational center, and at first we don't even notice that anything's happening. We're just living, and then gradually, bit by bit, we're pulled further and further in, and our momentum picks up until it's happening so quickly we can't even keep track of it, and then we are exactly at the center, exactly like the culture in which we live. That's enculturation. If you were here a few weeks ago, I talked about we are studying the book of Daniel because the elders believe that our situation today as Christians in the West is very much like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego's situation in Babylon. They had been taken to live in a culture that was large and powerful, the greatest and most prosperous nation in the world at that time, and was basically indifferent, maybe mildly hostile to their religion and to their practices. And today in the West, we've kind of left behind a culture that was at least officially for Christianity, and we now live in a culture that says mostly that what you believe about Jesus doesn't matter, but if it does matter, it's probably because it makes you a bigot. This is our world. It's very similar to Daniel's world. And so we can learn a lot about how to live in this world, how to resist enculturation by looking at Daniel's life. And so that's what we're going to do for the next few weeks, and that's what we're doing this morning. And we see in that long chapter basically two ways to live in Babylon, two ways to live in exile. The first is represented toward the beginning of the chapter by all of the other wise men and satraps and astrologers and magicians and sorcerers, and there's that whole long list. That's the first way to live, and then the second way to live we see in Daniel. And so in the first way to live, we see that on our own in exile, we're imprisoned. And then the second way with Daniel, we're going to see that with God in exile, faith frees us. So the first way, on our own in exile, we are in prison. And the second way, with God in exile, faith frees us. Okay, and we're imprisoned by enculturation. Faith frees us from enculturation. So that's where we're going, those two ways. The first way we see with these other wise men that on our own in exile, we are imprisoned. And the first thing to notice here is that all the other wise men in the first 10 or 11 verses of the chapter, they're living in exile too. They're in the same situation as Daniel. It was the practice of the Babylonian Empire and of most empires at that day and time that they would go around conquering countries, and then they would take some of the young, well-educated nobility of that country, bring them to Babylon, put them through Babylonian university, make them pledge Babylon, Babylon, Babylon fraternity, and grow up to be good Babylonians. And this has happened. These were who all these guys are. They didn't necessarily come from Jerusalem like Daniel did, although some of them may have. They come from Syria and Lebanon and Egypt and Persia and Philistia and all these other places, and they've been brought just like Daniel, just like his friends, and enculturated and taught to be Babylonian. They find themselves in the same situation. They are living in exile, and they display that enculturation has worked on them, that they've made it all the way down to the bottom of the funnel and dropped. They are utterly Babylonian to the core. They show that, right? So Nebuchadnezzar, he's the king, all-powerful tyrant, and he has a dream, and it messes with his head. He wakes up in the middle of the night. He sends a group email to all his advisors. Listen, staff meeting, first thing in the morning. Be there. And they all show up, and he says, tell me what I dreamed last night and interpret it for me. And they all freak out, because they know Nebuchadnezzar. They know that this guy is a little unstable, that there's no check on his power, and they have no idea what he dreamed last night. And so they respond in crisis mode. And you know that when in crisis, you go back to your basest instincts, your very core, fight or flight, right? And they react with what they've been enculturated with. They start stalling, manipulating, flattering. They're playing the Babylonian political game, because that game has made it from the periphery of their hearts all the way to the very center, right? So this is verse 4, right? The staff meeting's been convened. Nebuchadnezzar says, listen, I need you to do this impossible thing. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. No, you're not getting out of it that easy. And by the way, if you don't do this, I'm going to destroy you. Verse 7, they answered a second time and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will, please help us out here, Nebuchadnezzar. Help us help you. We're on your side. We got your back, but you got to give us something here. Right? They're playing games. Nebuchadnezzar's right when he responds. Right? The king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. He's got his advisor's number. He knows that they're playing games with him, that they've learned to survive in Babylon. They've learned to play the game. They've learned to manipulate and win the political one-upmanship that they've been forced to live in the midst of. And so he says, no, we're not doing that anymore. And their response is basically to lose their minds in verses 10 and 11. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Now, of course, they're completely right. This is beyond their power to do. But they've been enculturated to rely only on their own power, on their own ability to flatter, deceive, manipulate, say clever things, make the right friends. They've been so enculturated into this world that they can't think of any other way to respond. Now, do you suppose that there was a day in these young men's lives where they just decided, you know what, forget my old culture, I'm all in on Babylon. I'm doing this. Let's get as manipulative, as power-hungry as we can, and let's win the game. It's possible that that happened for a few of them. But I would contend that's pretty unlikely. Far more likely, bit by bit by bit, they became more Babylonian. They became more enculturated. They never made a conscious choice to do this. It just seemed inevitable the whole time, like the gravity that makes that penny slowly work its way down to the bottom of the funnel. They didn't decide to be enculturated. It happened to them. This is the danger of living in exile. Not that you're going to walk down Dixon Street after the service and somebody from the Corvallis Police Department is going to pull up and take out their revolver and say, renounce Jesus. That's not going to happen. But that bit by bit by bit, the culture in which we live that has little or nothing to do with Christ will win us over. Let me give you two examples of how this happens. One of the basic tenets of our culture, of this center of gravity around which we orbit, is that it's the American dream. You're gonna get a good education and you're gonna work hard and your prosperity and your wealth is going to grow over time. This is the way things are supposed to be. Now, I'm completely aware both that that is part of the culture and that that's not biblical. But I still get enculturated. Vanessa and I have lived in six apartments or houses in the time that we've been married, six houses in 10 years. We have always moved into a place that was either bigger or more expensive or both. So our first apartment was technically two bedrooms, but the second bedroom was smaller than some of your master closets and was about $500 a month. And then we moved into a for real two-bedroom apartment that was $600 a month. And then we made a slightly lateral move into another two-bedroom apartment that was also $600 a month, was a little bit bigger. And then our second child was on the way, and we moved into a three-bedroom house that was $800 a month. Then we moved into a nicer three-bedroom house, and now we're paying $1,200 a month. At no point did we sit down and decide, you know what? Every time we make a move, we want to spend more money and get more house. We're all in on the American dream. This is the plan. That was not a decision that we ever made. We are being enculturated. And we have never seriously considered moving into a cheaper or smaller place. That's never once happened in 10 years. It's never really been on the table because we are being enculturated. Because we're just going around, getting a little bit lower each time. Right. So that's one example. Another one, very different, has to do with self-fulfillment. If you grow up in our culture, the fundamental place that you look for truth is inside of you. Last night, I watched Kung Fu Panda 3 with my children. It was awesome. They couldn't stay sitting down. They were like up in the living room doing kung fu moves like Po. It was so cute. Right. The whole theme of the movie is that Po has to, the main character has to find himself and find the truth within. This was not surprising to me because that's the theme of every children's movie. Is that truth is inside of you and whatever you feel in your heart is what's most important. Now, my kids, just like your kids, are probably not in one day going to make a decision. You know what? I have no interest in following Jesus. I'm just going to follow my heart. Just like none of us, we don't read in Mark 8 where Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me and go, no, Jesus is wrong. He's not a good teacher. I'm going to follow Po, the Kung Fu Panda. But we get enculturated. And so it is now the norm, more common than not, for young, unmarried Christians who are otherwise biblically faithful and absolutely believe that the Bible is the Word of God to live with their boyfriends and girlfriends before they get married. At no point did they decide that the biblical ethic that sex is for the covenant of marriage, that doesn't matter, that that's evil. They just cannot conceive that God would ever go against the truth that they feel in their heart. Because they've been so enculturated to find truth within that, well, God is a God of love, and therefore he wants for me what I want for me. Right? That's enculturation. It happens. This is what happened to the wise men. It is what is happening to us. On our own in exile, we will be enculturated. We will get sucked in. We may not make a conscious decision to turn our back on Jesus and chase the American dream, or turn our back on Jesus and live not according to the Great Commandments, but according to Maslow's hierarchy of psychological needs. But we get enculturated. And we end up imprisoned. We may not notice this, but it happens, right? The day before Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, all of these wise men are on top of the world. They have great jobs. They had a fantastic last quarter in their business. They just got tenure. They're good to go. Their retirement account's looking good. And then a crisis hits, and they are absolutely controlled and enslaved by their enculturation. They cannot conceive of responding in any way other than a Babylonian way. Because they have been taught day in and day out to believe that they matter most. That their survival is what matters, and that their resourcefulness and abilities are the only thing that can save them. Enculturation has got them. And they're going round and around so quickly they have no hope of getting out of the well. On our own in exile, we end up imprisoned. The gravity of enculturation grabs hold of us. So that's the first way of living in exile. It's the way that, by default, we are all living in exile. Even if you didn't come in here as a Christian, right? These aren't necessarily people that came from Israel, from Jerusalem. We are all being enculturated, all being shackled by the culture in which we live, naturally. Unless we have a different center of gravity. Unless there's something else roping us in. And that's what Daniel has, and that's what allows him to live in a completely different way in exile. And so we see in the majority of the text that with God in exile, faith frees us, because faith frees Daniel in exile. So Daniel he's caught in exactly the same dilemma as the other wise men. He got the same middle of the night email about a staff meeting, right? This is verse 12. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out that the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Daniel's in the same pickle. He's stuck in the same spot, but he responds completely differently. Because Daniel has not been enculturated by Babylon. Daniel has been enculturated by God. His world does not orbit around Babylon, around the culture in which he lives. His world orbits around the God who gave him life. And so while the other wise men respond, they panic, they try to manipulate, they're trying to talk their way out of it, Daniel's response is very different and entirely God-centered. Daniel responds with prayer, with praise, and with proclamation. Daniel's response to crisis and exile is prayer, praise, and proclamation. And I submit to you that just like the other wise men, they responded out of their instincts, out of their long-formed, enculturated habits, so does Daniel. It's not like he's been orbiting around Babylon, and then all of a sudden he has a flash of insight and decides to pray. This is his habit. This is what he does every day. And so he responds on a difficult day in this way. So Daniel praise. Verse 17, then Daniel went to his house and made the manner known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, for our Sunday school people, that's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So what's going on here? Daniel has the same assessment as the other wise men. He's been asked to tell Nebuchadnezzar what dream the man had. And he has the same reaction. I can't do that. I don't have that power. He has the same reaction as the other wise men. Only the gods whose dwelling place is in heaven could do such a thing. But because Daniel's world orbits around God, because he believes that God matters most and not himself, he goes, then I'll ask God. And he turns to prayer. Because Daniel is in the habit of prayer. We learn in chapter 6, Daniel prays multiple times a day, every day, throughout his whole life. It's just what he does. Whatever happens to be going on a given day, he turns to prayer. When he's faced with something that he obviously can't handle, he has the same response. Rather than going, oh no, I can't do this, there's nothing to do, Daniel says, I can't do this. God, help me. And then God does help him. God reveals the dream. And Daniel's response continues with praise. Verse 20, Daniel answered God and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter. Daniel receives the insight and he doesn't say, yes, I prayed such an awesome prayer. What faith have I that God would answer me? It's all about thanking God. It is God-centered. He's not enculturated to think that he matters most, that his faith, that his prayers matter most. And so he's prepared both for the crisis and for the success to stay centered on God. And he continues, he proves this when he comes to the king, and the king's ready to give him everything, right? If you actually can do this, I'll give you lands and titles and wealth. It's going to be awesome. And Daniel says in verse 27, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Even in front of the king, Daniel wants no credit. He proclaims rather that God matters most. He's not interested in having a good reputation in the culture. He just wants God to be known. From beginning to end, Daniel's response is entirely about God. Now, we could read this, and the application could be, when you get in crisis, respond by being God-centered. Respond by praying, by praising, and by proclaiming. Right? And that's a sound application from the text. If that's what you take away, when you get in crisis, you will not respond that way. Because you are right now, today, and every day being enculturated to think that you matter most. And if you go through life that way, you'll be way too far down the funnel when the crisis hits to respond the way Daniel responded. We have to begin now, every day, to be enculturated not by what's around us, but by the one who made us. We need, as we talked about a few weeks ago, creative, distinctive habits of faithfulness. Like Daniel and his friends, we're going to eat differently every day to remind ourselves that we're not of Babylon, we're of God. We're going to pray every day, whether it seems like we need to remind ourselves that we're not of Babylon, we're of God. You must have these kind of habits. Whatever your job is, if you work, you are being enculturated to put more and more and more of yourself into your work. If you're a business owner, if you're a professor, if you work at HP, if you work at the hospital, if you're in the public schools, put in a little bit more. Invest a little bit more. It's just this deadline. Just get this done. And then this, and then this, and then this. What are you going to do to not be enculturated by that, but be enculturated by God? What time in the middle of your work week are you going to set aside to focus not on the task at hand, but on God? If you're a professor, are you going to step away from your desk to walk around campus and pray for all of the other departments? If you're an engineer or a teacher, are you going to send an email saying, I can't meet that deadline this week? And instead spend those extra hours studying scripture or visiting a neighbor? What kind of creative, distinctive habits of faithfulness are you going to develop so that you are being enculturated by God? What if you're a parent and you are being enculturated, as we all are parents, to believe that the success of your child matters most? And so every time you hear another parent talking about how little Timmy just got a scholarship to Harvard, you have the overwhelming urge to say, well, my daughter, she got the participation trophy at field day last week. Because the success of my kids is what matters most, and I have to let you know that my kids are successful, otherwise who am I? Is there a simple, repetitive, one or two sentence prayer that you're going to pray every time you get caught in that instinct to say, it's not about me being a father, it's about you being my father. Thank you for being my father. You are enough. What kind of creative, distinctive, everyday habit of faithfulness are you going to build in? If you're a young person, if you're 35 or under, you know, or if you know anybody in that age bracket, I promise you, we are being bombarded every day from every angle with, just be true to yourself. Your heart is free. Have the courage to follow her. That's Braveheart. Love that movie. Terrible advice. Right. We're getting hit with that by parents, teachers, advertisements. It's all over the place. What kind of creative, distinctive habit are you going to build in to specifically deny yourself? To say, yes, I do want that, and so I'm not going to have it. And it almost doesn't matter what it is. ice cream, Netflix. I don't care. Have a creative habit that centers you on God and not on the culture. Or go the other way age-wise if you're retired, right? You are being enculturated to believe that from now until the day you die is playtime. You earned it. You saved up. Go have some fun. Get the best tea times. Take a trip. Sleep in. Actually read the whole newspaper. For the life of me, I don't know why anybody would find that fun, but you can do it if you want. Right? That's what you're being enculturated to believe. What kind of creative, distinctive habit are you going to have that centers you not around that, but around God? Are you going to make extra visits to see that cantankerous, difficult to deal with parent? Are you going to volunteer? Mentor one of those crazy millennials that never seems to show up on time when you schedule to meet with them? We cannot allow ourselves to be enculturated and then when the crisis hits, thinks that we're going to respond with prayer and praise and proclamation. It has to be an everyday, multiple times a day habit. And the way that that works, the basis for that, is the same as the basis for Daniel. This isn't going to come out of our own will. This didn't come out of Daniel's own will. It's going to come out of trust in God. Daniel could do this because he knew with absolute certainty that God was powerful and that God was good. The interpretation of the dream, I hope you notice, it's not like Daniel could just straddle in there and tell Nebuchadnezzar what's going on. Because the interpretation of the dream is, you're going down. You, guy who has dreams and then threatens to kill everybody to make yourself feel better, I'm here to tell you that you're going down. That you think you're in charge, but you're not. The only way Daniel delivers that message is if he's taught himself to believe every day that it is God who is in charge. That he can say with absolute conviction the end of the interpretation in verses 44 and 45. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure. God's making a kingdom that will never be destroyed. You, Nebuchadnezzar, the all-powerful, almighty one who might kill me any second now, your kingdom's coming apart at the seams already. Only God is powerful. Only God is everlasting. Everlasting. He is in charge. I'm putting my trust in him and not in you. I've been preaching that to myself every day. And now in the moment of crisis, I am prepared to actually believe it. And to believe not only that God is powerful, but that God is good. And the great demonstration of God's goodness here is that he is merciful to Nebuchadnezzar. Verses 46 and 47. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries. For you have been able to reveal this mystery." This whole thing started with God sending Nebuchadnezzar a dream out of grace. And I want you to realize this. We want today to believe that we're for a God who's gracious towards everybody. But we have exceptions, right? Like, Hitler's not going to be in heaven. Nebuchadnezzar is Hitler. He's Vladimir Putin. He's President Erdogan in Turkey. He's Idi Amin. Geographically, he's Saddam Hussein. This is ancient Iraq. He's the guy we can't stand. We know is evil, needs to be gotten rid of. And God, throughout the book of Daniel, again and again and again, is going to reach out to Nebuchadnezzar in mercy. to remind him who is really God. God's goodness extends to the people for whom we don't want them to get goodness. His mercy extends to the people for whom you and I have no mercy. That's how good God is. And Daniel knows this and is prepared to go and deliver mercy to the man who conquered his country, killed his friends, and dragged him off into exile. Only if we are prepared day in and day out by seeing the greatness of God's mercy will we be prepared to be merciful in the moment of crisis. And brothers and sisters, as much evidence as Daniel had of God's power and of God's mercy, we have so much more. Daniel had seen a dream. He had seen God reveal a mystery. We have seen God send his own son down to earth and then raise him from the grave and show his power by breaking the inevitable power of death. Daniel saw God's goodness and how far he was willing to extend his mercy to people who didn't deserve it. We have seen God's goodness and how far God is willing to go to give mercy to people like us who didn't deserve it. Because we have seen God sacrifice his own son for the sake of undeserving sinners like you and me. And our call is the same as Daniel's call, to center our lives not on anything that is going on outside of these walls or even inside these walls, but on the God who is powerful enough to conquer death and on the God who is good enough to die for us. Brothers and sisters, let us be enculturated every day by that God, by no one and nothing else. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for being the powerful and good God who is able to save us from the midst of anything and who desires to save us, who has saved us. And so we ask that you would give us strength to live well in exile, that we would be enculturated by you every day, and that faith in you would set us free to follow you when things are wonderful and when disaster looms. We put our trust in you, Jesus, for you have proven trustworthy. Amen.